The views expressed in this program are those of the participants.
How long before we dock, Wrights?
Well, just 30 minutes, sir. So I thought now might be a good time to share the intel I've uncovered on the Inconium. It appears they have some rather strange laws.
Strange how?
Well, on their ship, criticism is illegal.
A ship free of criticism, what a place that must be.
A world where no one is blamed or rebuked, and no one gets mocked or ridiculed.
That's what they say, but they'll never hold out after they meet you.
You screw up and no one tells you. What good's that?
I wonder why the Inconium made criticism illegal.
Well, according to their databanks, they believe when people criticize, they feel esteem-inflating superiority, which causes the pleasure chemical dopamine to be released in the brain.
And dopamine's bad?
Too much dopamine is like taking cocaine, sir. It overexcites the receptors between brain cells, causing hyperactivity and engorged self-worth.
So people who criticize get high on criticism?
It seems they become addicted, needing to criticize more and more to produce the same original high.
This explains so much! But criticism can be good, can't it? I mean, it forces people to become better.
Well, not always, sir. I mean, take you.
Welcome, everyone. It is Thursday, April 27th, 2023. I'm Bob Metz, and this is Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online. Join us for an hour of discussion that's not right-wing, it's just right.
Fade into color, and color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be alright.
We find ourselves today living in a world where criticism is indeed being made illegal. All depending on, of course, who's doing the criticizing and who's the one being criticized. We certainly managed to demonstrate that on our past two broadcasts, dealing with the transgendered community that was triggered into a frenzy and violence, purportedly in reaction to a simple statement like, "Children cannot consent," on a sign displayed by Billboard Chris. This irrational reaction is certainly not unique to the trans activists. It is associated with a much greater organized campaign, now broadly labeled as woke culture, about which we'll have more to say during the closing quarter of today's presentation. But first, let's entertain another view on how to explain the bizarre and irrational behavior that we have been witnessing, one that we shall investigate right after our reminder that you can write us at feedback@justrightmedia.org. Hear us on WBCQ and on Channel 292 Shortwave. Follow and like us on your favorite podcast platform and visit us at justrightmedia.org, where you can access all of our social media links, archived broadcasts, and the support button that makes it easy for you to support the show. Because as you know, your financial support is appreciated and is what makes this show possible. Now, for the past two shows, our general topic of conversation has been the so-called trans movement and what it represents in terms of its significance to the rest of us. It is important to keep in mind that the whole trans ideology is but one symptom of a much greater mental and moral impairment that has been given the name of woke, another anti-concept made up out of thin air to cloud everyone's ability to think and identify the true nature of its evil. In explaining the irrational statements, actions, and violence of so many who see themselves as transgendered, I suggested that their real conflict was not with their critics, but with the fact that reality itself was not cooperating with their woke ideologies and definitions, and that they are projecting this frustration, anger, and outrage onto others. I also said that these activists hate themselves and are trapped in their own denial of that reality. Having last week identified the trans activists as being both evil and mentally ill, I have to tell you, I was stunned by an entirely different narrative on those two very points, yet completely parallel to my own, that was posted on April 19th by none other than the amazing Polly's Polly St. George. But in her narrative, trans activists were not the focus of her account, yet it served both as an illustration of our own interpretation and as the inspiration for this week's continuing discussion on this very important theme. By now, I hope that most of you appreciate that we are being confronted with a political and social threat far more significant than its myriad of individual symptoms, whether expressed through gender ideologies, climate change ideologies, vaccine ideologies, woke ideologies, or follow the science ideologies, whatever. And this is not a novel political virus, except for the variant epistemological wrappers under which it is sold. Again, what for me is particularly noteworthy about the following audio bite we're about to hear is the amazing parallel, speaking of amazing, between our own narrative over the previous 2 weeks and that of Amazing Polly's in hers. Amazing Polly is speaking as a Christian, applying Christian values as she understands them to the same phenomenon we discussed last week through the philosophical analysis of the conflict between the primacy of consciousness and the primacy of existence. But the issues and questions that she raises and the conclusions she arrives at are emerging in a wave of similar observations being expressed by other voices. Two significant examples that come to mind are James Lindsay's address to the European Parliament concerning the woke phenomenon on April 10th, and Tucker Carlson's keynote address at the 50th anniversary celebration of the Heritage Foundation on April 21st, only days before his unceremonious departure from the Fox Network, which we'll be talking about on future shows. Now, there's a lot to digest here, and a lot of food for thought, which we shall attempt to chew and swallow or spit out when we return after this.
Today I'm going to talk about, it's almost sort of the crossover between psychology and religion, because what I'm going to talk about is evil and one psychologist's perspective on what evil is. In the video, I'm going to be playing some sections of the audiobook from M. Scott Peck called The People of the Lie. I remember really being moved by M. Scott Peck's sort of scientific analysis of the nature of evil. And that's what this book is. He's a psychologist, a psychiatrist, and he was trying at the time when he wrote this book to get evil classified as a form of mental illness. Obviously, he did not succeed in doing so. And in my personal opinion, I believe that he was unsuccessful for two reasons. One is if you mention the word evil to secular people, they reject it because it's too religious, it's too woo-woo for them, it's too old-fashioned. You know, it's anti-progressive, it's anti-technical. If you mention evil, it conjures God and faith and virtue, and they hate that. The second reason I think Scott Peck was unsuccessful in his bid to have evil classified as a mental illness is that, I know this is a little controversial, but I think that the current paradigm that we're living in today was brought about by people who themselves are either sociopathic, psychopathic, or evil. And they didn't want even define this sort of mental illness. They don't want science to have any part of that. Because if you've noticed, the scientific community in the last however many decades has striven to strip religion from the world. Like, you can't be a faithful person and also a scientist. They've tried to drive this wedge as if the two things cannot exist in the same world. I fundamentally disagree with that. I think science is glorious, and I do not think that any part of it contradicts faith in God. Myself, I don't see any clash, but they do. And so we're playing in their playing field right now. And that's why I have to frame this in terms of psychology and psychiatry, because that's acceptable to the scientific, secular, rationalist, materialist, reductionist worldview. And the scientific, rationalist, reductionist, materialist worldview people are who I am trying to reach, because controversial thing that's happening right now, in my opinion, is that people who think they are doing good are actually doing evil. They are doing this thing, this virtue signaling thing, where it's a performative act to be good rather than actually being good. And in my personal opinion, science is responsible. Technocracy is responsible for this. They have subdivided, categorized, compartmentalized people's minds to the point where they are able to do evil in the name of good. As I've said a dozen times, probably, we are far beyond being able to use facts and figures to convince people that what they're doing is wrong. They are ideologically possessed, and they are mentally ill. And the mental illness that they suffer from, at least according to M. Scott Peck, is evil. They're evil. I think it's important for me to mention to you that he does not believe that evil people are psychopaths. I don't think he even believes they're sociopaths. Because from what I understand from his work, he thinks that psychopaths and sociopaths are people who are devoid of conscience. So they operate in this world completely differently than the rest of us humans who are burdened by guilt and by our conscience. So he separates evil people from psychopaths, okay? And this is a very important distinction because, as I've said myself many, many times, if we as a good species, as human beings, 95% or more of us are good. We are good. We do have a conscience. We are not evil. If we only had to deal with psychopaths and sociopaths and people without conscience, I believe we would be better off than we are today. Because we would be able to recognize them and deal with them. They would be such a minority, they would be so aberrant, that we would just step in there and rid them from our midst. Now, I'm not saying that psychopaths aren't a problem. They are. They're generally the leaders of all the evil people. Like, take, for instance, Bill Gates, who I think is a psychopath. Obviously, I don't even know the man, and I'm not a psychologist or psychiatrist, but from what I know, I would say that Bill Gates is a psychopath, like an apex predator psychopath. And all the people who work at his organization, who have ever sent him money, who have ever sat down in a room with him, who have had the power, but who have never stopped him, who have never blown the whistle on him, etc. All of his enablers, they are the problem. And they are evil. Because, unlike Bill Gates himself, the apex predator psychopath, who is operating as a broken, incomplete specimen of a human being, in my opinion, missing a conscience, constantly seeking to win a game, no matter what the price to other humans. Unlike him, the people who support him and surround him and don't stop him and work for him and kind of suspect something's wrong but don't do anything about it and keep drawing a paycheck from him and taking his money, these people are evil because they know better. And the reason they don't stop him and the reason they keep quiet is because they're ashamed. It's not because they don't see what they're doing is wrong. It's because they do see what they're doing is wrong, or they sense it on some level. But they have no courage to stand up. They would rather advance and protect the lie than stop it. They are so devoid of conscience, but they're so terrified of being associated with something bad because of their shallow self-esteem that they would rather continue hurting people so that they're never faced with their own complicity. Do you know what I'm saying? And that is evil. Because they've made a conscious decision to continue supporting a psychopath, in spite of the harm that it's causing. Now, Scott Peck says that the central defect of evil is the refusal of these people to acknowledge their sin. He uses the word sin. I know that probably triggers some people right there because you're thinking, oh, that's religious and I don't believe in sin and sin is a lie. Sin just keeps us from doing the things that we want. It makes us feel guilty for no reason. But that's not true. We have conscience and guilt for a reason. Whether or not there's religion, there's conscience. So Scott Peck just uses the word sin as an easy way to describe the transgressions these people have done.
If evil people cannot be defined by the illegality of their deed or the magnitude of their sins, then how are we to define them? The answer is by the consistency of their sins. While usually subtle, their destructiveness is remarkably consistent. This is because those who have crossed over the line are characterized by the absolute refusal to tolerate the sense of their own sinfulness. More than anything else, it is the sense of our own sinfulness that prevents any of us from undergoing a similar deterioration. A predominant characteristic of the behavior of those I call evil is scapegoating. Because in their hearts they consider themselves above reproach, they must lash out at anyone who does reproach them. They sacrifice others to preserve their self-image of perfection.
Speaking from personal experience, this seems very, very true to me. The destructiveness of these people is that they cannot have you get near to the truth that hurts them. I have noticed that there's a weird social impetus now towards it being rude if you say a truth to somebody. And it's now your fault for noticing this and saying it. Like, you are the bad person. You are intolerant. You are a Karen. Because you notice something that is a flaw, like a big, dangerous flaw. Am I even making any sense? I don't know.
Evil, then, is most often committed in order to scapegoat. And the people I label as evil are chronic scapegoaters. They attack others instead of facing their own failures. As life often threatens their self-image of perfection, evil people are often busily engaged in hating and destroying that life, usually in the name of righteousness. The fault, however, may not be so much that they hate life as that they do not hate the sinful part of themselves.
Clearly, scapegoating is the impetus behind all of the genocides that have ever happened. All of our troubles are caused by whatever group, X group. Doesn't even matter at all what the group is. If you get to a point where you say all of our troubles are caused by X group, then you are scapegoating. And now here is a difficult thing. Because here I am saying all of our troubles are caused by evil people. So am I scapegoating them? I know that they would love to frame that, and they would. That's exactly how they would come back at me. How can you say that? You're doing exactly what you're accusing us of doing, they would say. I don't know. I'll leave that one to everyone else to figure out. But scapegoating, it's a very, very deep phenomenon that, to me, this is one of the lessons, the main points of Christianity, is we ended sacrifice. We ended scapegoating. Jesus did. I didn't. I wasn't there. But we're supposed to honor that tradition. We do not take an innocent being, whether it's an animal or a human, we do not take an innocent being and then put our sins onto it symbolically and kill it so that we can be absolved of the things we did. Similarly, we don't heap our sins onto an innocent being and then shun those beings and send them off into the wilderness. Sacrifice is tied hand in hand with scapegoating, because what it always comes down to is that the guilty party transfers their guilt onto another so that the other can be symbolically punished for the sins of the person who actually did the sin, committed the sin, told the lie, kept the secret, killed, cheated, stole, whatever it was they did. And Christianity is the only religion that I know of that offers a hand and says, if you confess your sins, your transgression, you don't need to sacrifice anyone or anything. The secret is you admit you did it wrong. You transgressed, you sinned, you cheated, you lied, you stole, you killed, you maimed, you hated, you dishonored, you desecrated. You admit it, you repent, and you can be free. This is the beauty of Christianity, the end of scapegoating, the end of sacrifice, that sort of sacrifice. Not personal sacrifice, that's a different thing.
And because it's a different thing, it's not a sacrifice. To make a sacrifice or to be sacrificed involves giving up a higher value for a lower value or for no value at all. What I found particularly surprising and refreshing in terms of what Amazing Pauli said about Christianity and sacrifice is that it was almost an exact opposite view of that I've heard expressed by many Christians who insist that sacrifice is a virtue and that altruism is a virtue. That quote-unquote different kind of sacrifice mentioned is not sacrifice, which is why it is different in the first place. There's a bit of irony in this casual use of the term sacrifice. If you think about it, it's another form of virtue signaling. For example, the supposedly proud parents who boast that they've sacrificed a cottage they plan to buy up north in order to help pay for their kids' college or university education. Well, if it was indeed a sacrifice, then what they're telling us is that they valued the cottage more than the education of their kids, in which case their decision was immoral. But if they valued the education of their children more than owning a cottage up north, then they made no sacrifice at all. They chose a higher value over a lesser one. And if that kind of decision is to be considered a sacrifice, well, that would mean that every free choice ever made by anyone involves a sacrifice. I sacrificed the vanilla pudding for the chocolate-flavored one instead, but I sure still like vanilla. Well, of course, that's not a sacrifice. That's a free choice. Now, Pauli St. George posits that secular people reject the word evil because it's too religious. I'd like to challenge that perception because that's completely contrary to my own understanding and experience. I don't know of anyone who rejects the word evil because they're not religious. The word is used liberally in many non-religious contexts. It has to be, because evil exists. Ayn Rand used the word more than most preachers from the pulpit. Now, a little later in the show today, we'll be hearing someone else use the term secular in the same context as did Pauli St. George, in contrast to a belief system based on some established religion. Now, I used to appear very frequently and quite regularly on one of the most religious television networks in Canada, the Crossroads Television Network, CTS, where I appeared on shows like The Christine Williams Show, Michael Corrin's Show, Rhonda London, and on an occasional miscellaneous panel discussion. Whether Christian, Muslim, Jewish, atheist, or otherwise, every one of them, when asked, spoke to the virtues of living in a secular society, within which each could freely practice their own religion or philosophy without fearing the censure of the other. My Funk and Wagnalls Dictionary defines secular as, quote, of this world or the present life, temporal, worldly, distinguished from spiritual, not necessarily abandoning it, not under the control of the church, civil, etc. Now, expressed in biblical terms, you might say that secularism was defended by Christ when he said, render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and render unto God the things that are God's. And as to the word evil, again, my dictionary defines evil as morally bad, wicked, causing injury, or any other undesirable result, that which is injurious, that which causes suffering or misfortune, some particular act, characteristic, etc., that is evil, as in one of the evils of the political system. Now, the standard of any valid morality, whether secular or spiritual, is life itself. Now, under objectivist ethics, regarded as atheistic, good and evil are described thusly, quote, since reason is man's basic means of survival, that which is proper to the life of a rational being is the good. That which negates, opposes, or destroys it is the evil. Thinking is man's only basic virtue from which all others proceed. And his basic vice, the source of all his evils, is the willful suspension of one's consciousness, the refusal to think, not blindness, but the refusal to see, not ignorance, but the refusal to know. It is the act of unfocusing your mind and inducing an inner fog to escape the responsibility of judgment on the unstated premise that a thing will not exist if only you refuse to identify it, end quote. And that, in a nutshell, describes everything we've been seeing within all of the so-called woke movements, particularly obvious with the trans activists. And by the way, when it comes to the evil of sacrifice, objectivist ethics is entirely on side with what Pauli St. George's Christian ethics were telling her. But look at who is not in agreement with these ethics. A name very familiar to everyone, none other than Barack Obama himself. And before Amazing Pauli concludes on the return side of our upcoming bumper, on this side, the next voice you will hear is that of Barack Obama, long before he became President of the United States for two consecutive terms. This is from an April 14, 2015 posting to the site of Syndicate News, which in turn featured a speech given way back in 1995 by Barack Obama in front of an audience that came to hear him read accounts of his childhood and biracial background. Now see if you can read between the lines and understand what Obama was really calling for when it came to his advocacy of sacrifice.
Basically, Americans are decent people. I think the problem with Americans, and this is obviously a large generalization, so you will excuse me as I generalize about Americans. Americans don't like to sacrifice. This generation in particular does not like to sacrifice. Our whole politics is geared towards not wanting to sacrifice and trying to do everything on the cheap. And solving the racial problems in this country at this stage has very much to do with economics and class and dealing with entire generations and segments of the society that need help. And that's going to cost some money. And that's going to require some sacrifice. I think that the current political climate can change. And I think that if you talk to young people, I think there have been changes. So I'm not one of these people who says that nothing's changed. I think it's the best of times and the worst of times for race relations in this country.
By the way, I heard Cornel West speak at Harvard at noon today, and he's very pessimistic. That's my interpretation.
Well,
he thinks democracy isn't working.
Well, you know, Cornel West has to go back to his Bible, right? You got to have faith. You know, got to have faith. I say that facetiously, but I do think that there is an element of faith involved in this project of democracy. There's an element of faith involved in the notion that you can create a society and a country that doesn't all look alike and sound alike and talk alike.
We always hear in criminology that the cover-up is worse than the crime. Well, that goes 1,000 times for our psychology or our spirit. 1,000 times.
What is the cause of this failure of self-hatred? This failure to be displeasing to oneself, which seems to be the central sin at the root of the scapegoating behavior of those I call evil. The cause is not, I believe, an absent conscience. There are people, both in and out of jail, who seem utterly lacking in conscience or superego. Psychiatrists call them psychopaths or sociopaths. Guiltless, they not only commit crimes, but may often do so with a kind of reckless abandon that is not particularly characterized by scapegoating. This is hardly the case with those I call evil. Utterly dedicated to preserving their self-image of perfection, they are unceasingly engaged in the effort to maintain the appearance of moral purity. They worry about this a great deal. They are acutely sensitive to social norms and what others might think of them. Like Bobby's parents, they dress well, go to work on time, pay their taxes, and outwardly seem to live lives that are above reproach. The words image and appearance and outwardly are crucial to the understanding of the morality of the evil. While they seem to lack any motivation to be good, they intensely desire to appear good. Their goodness is all on a level of pretense. It is, in effect, a lie. This is why they are called the people of the lie.
Remind you of anyone or anything? The concept of virtue signaling? The keeping up appearances, nature of all of the folks around us who we'll take the vaccine, we'll wear the masks, we'll do the social distancing, we'll gather together in mobs to shame those of us who won't. They are literally dedicated to the lie. All they care about is appearing just. And as many other psychologists and psychiatrists have pointed out over the years, they feel security by going towards a group mentality. Wherever the bigger group is, they'll hide in the middle of them, like a zebra in a pack. You feel more secure on the inside than on the outside. Who are the backwards people? Is it people with religion who believe in individual virtue and the individual mandate to live up to the laws of God? Or is it the people who think like pack animals and just want to hide in the middle of a group? And think about what you're seeing out there and what's happening right now. It is evil to scapegoat. It is evil to pretend virtue. You know, like Scott Peck said, keeping up appearances. All they care about is what the pack thinks of them. They don't care at all about actually doing good. In fact, they're too lazy to even think about what good is. We now live in a society, I believe, where the experts that they trot out on the news and the media, which repeats messaging and brainwashes people, they are on the side of the evil and the psychopaths. So what chance do these pack animals have? It is up to us, the virtuous and the people who understand right and wrong. And we have set our sights way higher than the opinion of the mob. We are trying to please a much, much higher power. Whether you believe in God or not, it doesn't matter. You know what I'm talking about.
Indeed I do. And I think most people hearing those words would too. You are listening to Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online. Now, did you catch what Obama was actually calling for with all of his altruistic sacrificial talk? Americans don't like to sacrifice. Our whole politics is geared trying not to sacrifice. Solving the racial problem is going to require some sacrifice. It's going to cost some money. Well, consider the meaning of Obama's revelatory speech, in which he is extolling racism and theft and sacrifice and calling on the Bible to justify having faith in this project of democracy. Wow. That's right out of the Biden Bible, which, of course, has been written by Obama. Democracy, 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 and never freedom, rights, or justice. Obama is explicitly saying that white folks will have to sacrifice their money so that the government, the political system, can hand that money over to black folks. Now, how evil and racist can you get? Now, a few miscellaneous final points before we go completely woke here. M. Scott Peck asked the question, what is this cause of this failure of self-hatred, this failure to be displeasing to oneself? Well, that question, of course, suggests the opposite of my own contention over the previous 2 weeks that these people do hate themselves, although I think we're really each saying something similar. I would say that it's not the failure of self-hatred that we're witnessing, but the refusal to acknowledge it. Pauli St. George suggests that the scientific community has striven to strip religion from the world, that to place a wedge between faith and science as if they cannot coexist. And she says science is glorious and does not contradict with her faith in God. Well, perhaps not. But the scientific method does indeed conflict with faith as a way of acquiring knowledge. Knowledge is accumulated through reason and the scientific method. Science and religion are completely separate and distinct categories. Religion is concerned with ethics and morality, while science is exclusively concerned with discovering the truth about the physical world in which we live. And of course, you can apply your ethics and your morality to your study of science, but they're not the same thing. And I don't think that the scientific community as such is striving to strip religion from the world. It's the people of the lie who are doing that. It's the dictators and collectivists who have always confronted religion with hostility, because religious authority, or moral authority, is always in conflict with the authoritarianism of the state. Now, if there's a bottom line to Amazing Polly's argument, it is this, and I fully agree with it. Sacrifice is tied hand in hand with scapegoating. The guilty party transfers their guilt onto another. Well, we sure witnessed our share of watching the left project all of its evils and crimes onto the right. And the person the left wants to sacrifice the most to its collective is without doubt Donald Trump, who is running for president in the 2024 American election. And I suppose it's at this point that I can comfortably segue into our deeper journey into wokeness. Another Republican candidate for President of the United States in 2024 is a fellow named Vivek Ramaswamy, who we will soon hear describing the woke culture and its threat to America. Now, I'd already selected the following audio bite before learning about the speculation running high that it was his encounter with Don Lemon last week that got Lemon fired from CNN, thereby coincidentally finding Lemon sharing the experience of Tucker Carlson and Dan Bongino's departure from Fox News during the same week. And I recall watching that exchange, and it was appalling. The fake news and racism spewing from Lemon's mouth was simply embarrassing and outrageous. Nevertheless, and that aside, Vivek Ramaswamy is an American entrepreneur and is the author of Woke Inc., published in 2021, and The Nation of Victims, published in 2022. And what we're about to hear next was found on the site of Hillsdale College on May 20th, 21, and it was a speech that Ramaswamy delivered earlier on April 28th of the same year.
It's not a biological cancer. It's a cultural one. That new disease, that new infection, is spreading across our country like wildfire. It is one that even the best of science is not going to cure. And that new disease is called woke culture. It's the new secular religion in America. And its belief system centers on the idea that your identity is based on your race, your gender, and your sexual orientation, full stop. It posits that America is a systemically racist country, and that if you're black, you're inherently disadvantaged, and that if you're white, you're inherently privileged, no matter how much money you have, no matter what your upbringing was. Your race and gender govern who you are and what thoughts you're allowed to have. That's it. Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley summed it up pretty neatly last year, actually, when she unapologetically declared, "We don't need any more black faces that don't want to be a black voice. We don't need any more brown faces that don't want to be a brown voice," end quote. I'm going to guess that I don't fit her description of what counts as a brown voice. Here's the clever part about how this particular virus spreads. If you disagree with any of those claims, then that actually means you're just racist and you don't know it. And the more you resist a woke claim, the more that's seen to validate it. If you say, "I'm not racist," that means you are racist. If you say all lives matter, that somehow means that you believe that black lives don't matter. If you capitalize the W in white or fail to capitalize the B in black, you're racist. And there is no greater damnation in modern America than to be labeled a racist. So between pledging fealty to this new religion and being tarred with the scarlet R, everyday Americans are choosing to bend the knee. The consequences may be existential for America. This has created a new culture of fear in our country. Fear of losing your job, fear of failing a class at school, fear of becoming a pariah in your own community. And almost every day, somebody new is sacrificed at the altar and excommunicated from civil society for saying the wrong thing. This new culture of fear has completely eroded our culture of free speech in America. A good measure of the health of any democracy, especially American democracy, is the percentage of people who actually feel free to say what they actually think in public. And right now, I am sorry to say that we are doing abysmally on that metric. According to a recent survey conducted by the Cato Institute, over 60% of Americans, an overwhelming majority of this country, says they are afraid of saying what they believe because of the current political climate. That is not America. It is not the country that my parents came halfway across the world to join. It is not the country I learned to pledge allegiance to as a kid. We have a new Red Guard in our country that's reminiscent of the Chinese Cultural Revolution, except instead of adhering to Marxism, the new guiding principle for today's Red Guard is this new form of wokeism. So that's where we are today. In the name of diversity, we've sacrificed true diversity of thought. In the name of democracy, we've sacrificed our most important democratic norms of free speech and open debate. In the name of inclusion, we've created an exclusionary culture where certain views are just not welcome. What we really need in this country is a cultural cure. The real solution to these problems is actually to gradually rebuild a shared vision of American identity that is so deep and so powerful that it dilutes this wokest nonsense to irrelevance. The answer does not actually begin with the government. It begins with everyday citizens who are willing to speak up and challenge the new woke dogma at school, at work, at home, and in their community. It also means cultivating a shared identity, both in ourselves and in the next generation of Americans, with the revival of civic education that we have long missed in this country. Our schools teach our kids to view our history with shame rather than pride. Patriotism is on the decline. Religion has nearly disappeared. What does it even mean to be an American today in the year 2021? I cannot remember a time in my life where we more badly needed an answer to that question. And I personally believe that answering that question is the hardest and most important work we will ever do as Americans. Today, as a people, we are hungry for a cause. We are hungry for a sense of purpose. We are hungry for identity. The absence of a shared cause in America is the black hole at the center of our nation's soul. And when you have a vacuum that runs that deep, bad things start to fill the void. That is part of what makes wokeness so appealing as the new religion of our time. It is the modern version of opioid for our masses. As Americans, our jobs in the coming years is to fill that void with something more meaningful than just wokeness. Americans are hungry for a cause, and yet we have forgotten that in America, our country itself can be that cause.
Hi, welcome to the Science Channel. From an evolutionary perspective, woke people are the strongest, most capable form of hominoids history has ever seen. They're superior human beings. I'll explain what makes the woke apex predators on top of nature's food chain, but first, you have to understand, woke people didn't just appear overnight. In simple terms, evolution is what we do at a genetic level to win the competition of survival against other forms of life in nature. Now, evolution takes time, so to take a look at the woke's earliest human ancestors, we need to rewind the clock back about 10 years to the pre-Paleo-Wokolithic era. Back then, you had a primitive people known as Homo sapiens. These were a type of hominises who survived using primitive skills such as strength, bravery, intelligence, and productivity. And interestingly, their species only had two genders. Then midway through this era, just after the world ended because of climate change according to Al Gore, the Homo sapien developed into Homo sapien justicus, or commonly referred to as social justice warriors. They were the first pre-woke ancestors who originated online hatred. It's believed they understood fire, and they also learned how to make weapons out of keyboards. And they began mating primarily with their own hands while staring at computer screens. That led us to the current Paleo-Wokolithic era that created the conditions for the Homo sapien non-binary wokeness to develop and thrive, or commonly referred to as the woke. They're a very advanced phylum of people who have evolved to shed what are now unnecessary prehistoric qualities, like gills, large canines, and self-responsibility. And along with developing the ability to have an inability to tolerate even the slightest bit of discomfort, they've also evolved to develop 72 genders. Now, when we've studied the fossilized evidence of primitive people, we've discovered strong evidence that suggests they did all their thinking in their brains. Whereas the woke carry around additional brains in the form of devices like phones, tablets, and TVs, which is where all their thinking comes from. Now, let's not forget how the woke became the apex predators at the top of the food chain in the first place. Was it by outwitting, outsmarting, or being stronger than their competition? No, it's because they canceled all the predators that used to be above them. It's an advanced capability that no other species in nature has ever achieved. The former predators at the top of the food chain, like orca whales, lions, and gorillas, made the mistake of competing against other species by being better than them. Unlike the woke, their lack of adaptivity to become degenerates clearly led to their downfall from the top step of nature's podium. The woke have gotten to where they are not by judging people based on the content of their character, but by judging them based on their skin color and pronouns. They've evolved to have no character, so it simply doesn't matter to them. Darwin's theory of evolution is survival of the fittest. Yet to better understand the genetic development of the woke, our scientific analysis of stool droppings from Hollywood celebrities, along with carbon dating Molotov cocktail shrapnel from downtown Portland, has proven that what's more true than survival of the fittest is survival of the outraged. Whereas those who archaically lived peacefully, productively, and lovingly have simply died off, because they weren't fit to survive. Now, the woke have a high degree of intellectual capacity for outrage, which makes them capable of even being offended by their own God-given genders. And where baboons speak a language of throwing feces at each other, the woke speak a language of virtue signaling at each other. And they thrive eating a diet primarily based in propaganda. When learning about the woke, It's best to think of evolution as a spectrum. Intelligence evolved into outrage, freedom evolved into obedience, love evolved into hate, and self-responsibility evolved into socialism. Studying ancient iterations of people reveals interesting hieroglyphic evidence that they worshipped a rather primitive interpretation of a non-human god, one that was all-loving in them and around them at all times, and to be trusted as the most important source of life guidance, whereas the woke have several gods in human form that they're very obedient to. The woke have advanced their genetic IQs to the point that they no longer base facts on truth. Now, this is an exciting intellectual advancement that previous hominis eras only could have imagined. And the advanced lack of activity in the cerebral cortex of the woke has allowed them to develop the ability to shapeshift objective reality, primarily by changing the definitions of words. Accordingly, staying locked in one's home for months at a time out of fear is an act of courage for the woke that would make the most courageous lion in the jungle look like a coward. We've found the now extinct primitive people had what's called a backbone, which is in part what led to their demise. But through genetic adaptation, the woke have replaced the backbone with conformity. The woke have an impressive ability to blame other people for virtually any problem they encounter, which allows them to quickly and easily overcome any obstacle. Their blame, along with their strong ability to victimize themselves over anything, are chief reasons why we think they've been able to evolve to be so advanced in such a short period of time. This has been just a brief glimpse into the fascinating evolutionary biology of the woke. Stay tuned for more scientific discoveries. We'll keep studying the woke until they make our planet uninhabitable.
Dictionaries define the word woke as the past tense of wake, while wake is defined as to emerge from sleep. Ironic. In the wake of example after example of politicians restricting the rights of free people to protest, criticize, or speak out peacefully, it's amazing how many people remain utterly asleep to this violation of freedom, or worse, in support of it. And the great irony is that these would be the people self-identifying as woke. Online, the term woke is broadly described as referring to a wide variety of quote-unquote awareness of social issues of some sort or other, which is the theory. But the practice is that woke is just the code word for Marxism, totalitarianism, communism, fascism, or whatever collectivist evil variant best fits the zeitgeist of the moment. In political terms, the left. Woke is just another BS term for disguising ancient and evil ideologies that ended in the destruction of human life every time they were applied. If the term woke is to have any objective meaning at all, it should be identified as the acronym for Worldwide Organized Killing Effort, because that's exactly what the movement is. But outside of any attempts to disguise and misrepresent its ideology, the term woke is, of course, not necessary, or redundant, if you will, since we've had the proper vocabulary to identify its nature long before any of the woke fell into their deep sleep of denial about themselves. With that thought in mind, allow me to close today's presentation with the following chilling passage from a book called Planned Chaos, written by Ludwig von Mises way back in 1947, and I quote, "History will call our age the age of the dictators and tyrants. We have witnessed in the last years the fall of two of these inflated supermen. But the spirit which raised these knaves to autocratic power survives. It permeates textbooks and periodicals. It speaks through the mouths of teachers and politicians. It manifests itself in party programs and in plays and novels. As long as this spirit prevails, there cannot be any hope of durable peace, democracy, the preservation of freedom, or of a steady improvement in the nation's economic well-being. Since the days of the Mongol invasions, mankind has not had to face such an unflinching and thoroughgoing aspiration for unlimited world supremacy." Listen to that. Many people believe that the coming of totalitarianism is inevitable. The wave of the future, they say, carries mankind inexorably towards a system under which all human affairs are managed by omnipotent dictators. It is useless to fight against the unfathomable decrees of history. The truth is that most people lack the intellectual ability and courage to resist the popular movement, however pernicious and ill-considered. Bismarck once deplored the lack of what he called civilian courage, bravery in dealing with civic affairs on the part of his countrymen. But neither did the citizens of other nations display any more courage and judiciousness when faced with the menace of communist dictatorship. They either yielded silently or timidly raised some trifling objections. One does not fight socialism by criticizing only some accidental features of its schemes. In attacking many socialist stands on divorce and birth control or their ideas about art and literature, one does not refute socialism. Those who find fault with Bolshevism and Nazism only for their anti-Christian leanings implicitly endorse all the rest of their bloody schemes. On the other hand, it is sheer stupidity to praise the totalitarian regimes for alleged achievements which have no reference whatever to their political and economic principles. The problems of society's economic organization are not suitable for light talk at fashionable cocktail parties. Neither can they be dealt with adequately by demagogues haranguing mass assemblies. They are serious things. They require painstaking studies. They must not be taken lightly. The socialist propaganda never encountered any decided opposition. It is not true that the masses are vehemently asking for socialism and that there's no means to resist them. The masses only favor socialism because they trust the socialist propaganda of the intellectuals. The intellectual leaders of the people have produced and propagated the fallacies which are on the point of destroying liberty and Western civilization. The intellectuals alone are responsible for the mass slaughters which are the characteristic mark of our century. They alone can reverse the trend and pave the way for a resurrection of freedom. Not mythical material productive forces, but reason and ideas determine the course of human affairs. What is needed to stop the trend towards socialism and despotism is common sense and moral courage. It may happen that fascism will be resurrected very soon under a new label and with new slogans and symbols. But if this happens, the consequences will be detrimental, for fascism is not, as the fascist trumpeted, a new way to life. It is rather a very old way towards destruction and death. End quote. Does all this sound familiar? Well, the latest label for fascism is woke. The latest slogans and symbols are own nothing and be happy, Black Lives Matter, build back better, and a whole host of evil notions that none of us are supposed to criticize. Which is why we will be doing exactly that when you join us again next week on our journey in the right direction. And until then, be right, stay right, do right, act right, think right, and be right back here. We'll see you then.
Fade into color, color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be all right.
Good evening, sir.
Evening, officer.
Do you know why I pulled you over, sir?
No, I haven't got a clue, no.
Been doing any criticising this evening, sir?
Criticising? No, not at all, no.
Well, it's just that we had a report of some illegal castigation in the diner this evening, sir. What about you lads? You been doing any criticising this evening?
No, no.
Little bit of chiding, perhaps?
Chiding, no.
How about blaming, sir?
No.
Harping? Little bit of panning?
Oh!
Not even scoffing?
Nothing.
You won't mind blowing into this criticising for me then, will you, sir?
What?
Go on, blow as hard as you can. You've got to read in the 95, sir.
Is that good? Bad? What does that mean?
It means that your friend is way over the criticism limit, sir. I may have to take him down to the station.
Oh, now, wait a minute.
You're telling me to wait, sir?
Well, yes.
Implying that I'm going too fast and therefore criticising me.
Look.
You're telling me to look. insinuating that my attention isn't focused in the correct direction, therefore implying that my
focus... I am not criticising you, okay?
Look, we're here to warn you that your ship is on a collision course with a very important moon called Planet Rimmer.
I'm going to let you off with a caution.
Caution? How dumb is this guy?